Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Cool. Here we are.
Here we are.
Thank you for doing this.
Mm,
my pleasure. Questions. You have some big books in front of you.
I do.
What are those?
These are Beethoven symphonies.
This is Radiolab. I'm Jad.
I'm Robert. And we are talking about the power of music.
Just drop them on the desk so we can feel the weighty massiveness of them. There you go.
Yeah.
And this is Alan Pearson,
conductor of the Brooklyn Philharmonic.
The Brook Phil.
The Brook Phil, yeah.
The B Phil.
Anyhow, I called up Alan. It's a lot of Beethoven
symphonies. That's a lot of Beethoven symphonies.
Because it turns out in those scores that he brought, there is this mystery that could completely transform how you feel about Beethoven, or at least how I have always felt about Beethoven, which is that I couldn't stand him.
Really?
Yeah.
Alan, too.
And I remember growing up and thinking, well, I'm a musician, I should love this, and I don't. Does that mean that maybe I'm a fraud? Am I a bad musician?
You know, like you would hear the fifth, the one that everybody knows.
You know, those first measures are like, bum, 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 bum. Very, like, heavy, ponderous.
Suffocating.
No.
Whatever you think of Beethoven, it turns out that the Beethoven that you and I know, that we all know, may in fact not be the Beethoven that Beethoven wanted us to know at all.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
All right, let me just start the story where it really begins.
Please.
You kind of have to go back all the way to the invention of this.
Beethoven was one of the first composers to work with the metronome. And the metronome came out in 1817, so he would have been 47 when the metronome came out for the first time.
So the metronome was this new gizmo.
Right, it was a new gizmo. And the inventor of the metronome...
Was his last name actually metronome? Like Bobby Metronome?
No, Mazel.
Mazel.
I'm sure I'm saying it wrong.
However you say his name, in 1817, this dude, after he'd invented the metronome...
brought his metronome to Beethoven and said...
check it out.
I want you to use this. And Beethoven's first response was, no, 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 this is not the way music works.
But then, as was not uncommon for Mr. B,
it seems he changed his mind and got really excited about the idea of using the metronome to fix for eternity what the tempos for all of his pieces should be.
As in this piece, don't play it at this speed. Play it like this. Now, keep in mind, at this point, Beethoven was pretty much at the end of his career.
Of the 9 symphonies... by the time he'd gotten the metronome, he'd written 8 of them.
So what he did was he went back.
And he marked in metronome markings for all of his symphonies.
And here's where the mystery really begins. Those tempo markings are fast, like really fast, like in some cases, obscenely fast.
You know, like, okay, take a piece like the 3rd symphony. For that piece... the first movement is marked at dotted half equals 60. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Which is almost impossible to play. Oh,
really fast.
Who's playing that fast?
Strings.
Alan got a couple string players together from the Brooklyn Phil to demonstrate just how hard it is to play the 3rd at Beethoven's tempo markings. Like this part coming up, check this out.
Wow.
Yeah, I stayed right with it.
That was great.
Alan
says when he tried to play that piece at that tempo with the entire orchestra,
there was one rehearsal where we got it up to tempo.
But when you do get it up to that speed, it's a completely different piece.
Yeah.
And then take the 5th, which has been played as slow as this right here. Dun, 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 dun. This is 74 beats per minute. Beethoven actually marked it here at 108 beats per minute.
Oh, no, that's ridiculous.
No, it's just a different feel.
That's too fast.
Well, it is for a lot of people. And according to Alan, for the last couple hundred years, people have been arguing about these tempo markings.
You know, to what extent did, like, those markings that he put in 1817 really represent his actual intentions?
Well, what's the debate? If he put them in, he put them in.
There are lots of ways that people debate them. One is there's a story that goes around that Beethoven's metronome was broken.
Really?
Yeah.
Like he had...
It was going too fast?
Not too fast, but that the numbers were wrong.
Although we now have Beethoven's metronome and it seems to work fine.
You have the metronome?
I believe somebody tracked it down.
That's music critic Matthew Guerreri, who's written a lot about Beethoven.
Tested it and it seemed to work okay.
And it matches up to all the other metronomes in the world.
Yeah.
Now,
and
another story that's sometimes used to explain the markings goes like this. That Beethoven actually did notate the tempos slower, but then he gave the pages to his assistants.
And now they needed to go off to the publisher, but they couldn't find them.
They somehow lost the papers.
And so they had to rewrite them.
And in their haste, they inadvertently put down the wrong numbers and sped up the pieces.
Clerical error. Explanational number two.
Yeah, but this one I don't find that plausible. I mean, he could have corrected them at some point, and, you know, he didn't just do this one time. He did it for all eight symphonies.
Huh.
And then there's speculation that...
Theory number three.
By the time he was doing all these metronome markings...
Beethoven was deaf.
Oh.
So Beethoven, by 1814, was basically completely deaf, and the metronome came out in 1817.
What does being deaf have to do with what speed you play the music on? I mean, you can't hear the music in any event.
It has to do with the space in which you're hearing the music. Like, if you're hearing the music just in your head,
yeah,
it's just kind of in the vacuum of your imagination.
Right.
You take that music and you put it into a room. Suddenly, you've got the acoustics of that room, which, if it's a big concert hall, are going to make all the notes muddy. The tails of one note are going to bleed into the attacks of the next. And so Alan says what always happens when you put music in a room,
you will play things a little bit slower
to maintain the clarity.
Right.
But Beethoven,
when he was making these metronome markings,
he was only hearing the music in his head,
not hearing it in the real world. And maybe had he heard it in the real world, would have done something different. But the counterargument is,
who cares?
If we can create the music that Beethoven heard in his head, isn't that something that's worth doing?
Up until recently, the answer has been no, because people have not generally performed these pieces at his markings. But both Alan and Matt think that we probably should just accept these accelerated tempos, you know, like with the fifth at 108. Just go with it.
Yeah, it's very possible that that's the speed he wanted. If that is the speed he wanted, it's a very interesting speed, because it's a tempo almost designed to make us feel uncomfortable. It's almost designed to disorient us.
Here's where we get to a fourth explanation for why Beethoven made these tempos super fast. Speculative, takes a little setup, but it's super interesting, I think.
There's something called Fjord's Law, which is a law. It was discovered in the 1860s by an Austrian doctor named Carl von Fjord.
And what this law says, according to Matt, is that when you ask people to guess tempos or lengths of time,
people will always overestimate short durations of time, and they'll always underestimate long durations of time.
To what does that mean, to underestimate?
Well,
you mean you guess backwards? Oh, that took...
Well, it's a kind of a complicated thing you just said. So let's just do it as a demonstration.
Okay.
I'm going to give you four beats, first slow, then fast. Your job is to guess where that fifth beat is going to land. So I'm going to give you four beats, and then you have to hit your pen where you think that fifth beat is going to fall. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, here's the first one, slow. Get ready. See, this is the law in action. You just rushed it.
I did not. Do it again.
All right. Okay, you were closer that time.
I was the same.
You rushed it a little bit, but you were closer.
I didn't rush it.
Now, if we do the same thing with a fast tempo, like I give you four, you guess the fifth, okay?
All right.
Here goes. Oh, come on. Try that again. You were late again.
I wasn't late.
You were
that
so
was
late.
Exactly. Measure it.
You were audibly
measure
late.
Measure the thing.
It's right here on the waveform.
Boom. 3, 7, 8.
Oh, yeah. You're 50 milliseconds late. So the point is, Fjord's Law says that when we have a slow tempo,
we'll tend to unconsciously try and speed it up.
And when we have a really fast tempo,
we will tend to unconsciously slow it down. And if you think about that for a minute, at some point, our perception has to flip over.
Because if we're unconsciously speeding up slow beats and slowing down fast beats, well, there's got to be
some particular point
right in the middle
where our judgment of time actually syncs up with actual time.
Where, in other words, we guess the tempo correctly.
Yeah, and it's called the indifference point.
According to most research, that point falls somewhere around this tempo.
94, 96 beats per minute.
If you give people four beats of this tempo and then ask them to guess the fifth, they usually get it right.
Yep.
And the really interesting thing is that this tempo, this little point,
is right about where people tend to dial back to when they don't want to perform Beethoven's fifth as fast as it's written.
In fact, when Allen asked his quartet to just play the fifth at whatever tempo felt right, they fell right back to this indifference point.
Well, so you're building to some theory here, aren't you?
Yeah, that maybe, just maybe, Beethoven was playing a kind of cat and mouse game, that he intuited that there was some point where we felt comfortable, where
every beat is coming exactly where we expect it to.
And it just feels right. And he never wanted his music to fall into that place. So if we like 92 beats per minute, he was going to push his tempos to 108. So it was just a little too fast. Every beat kind of coming a tiny bit too early.
So the piece is always, it's always just feels like it's running away from us in a very real psychological way.
And this fits with what we know about the guy. I mean, there are numerous anecdotes where he would push not just his audience, but his musicians, almost as if he wanted to hear them struggle.
When he was rehearsing his Ninth Symphony, those soloists walked out of rehearsal because he was pushing them beyond their limits.
That's Terrence McKnight, who hosts a classical music show on WQXR.
Maybe that's what those quick tempos were about.
About maybe pushing the musicians so they'd miss a few notes.
He didn't care about the notes.
So that the music was right on the edge.
You know, this is, you know, something's impending. This is danger. This is ferocious.
And think of it this way, says Terrence.
You know, Beethoven was kind of an outsider.
Didn't come from privilege. He was a short, dark-skinned dude.
Now, some people say that his grandmother was of African descent.
He probably stood out in 19th century Vienna.
Oh, my God.
So you could say, here's this guy who's always on the outside, and he wants his music to always express that. But he can see into the future to a time when his music would become
the canon.
The man.
Yes. Maybe that's not what he wanted. Mm. If you read it that way, these tempo markings are kind of liberating. It's like this message from 1817 saying, get me out of here. And interestingly, when I was talking with Alan, he sort of implied, without quite saying it outright, that one of the ways that you can keep orchestral music exciting in a time when it's not for a lot of people is by just playing things faster. Have you ever done Beethoven faster than his markings?
No. The fifth you could play faster. I've never heard it done.
You never heard it faster than 108?
I would think you could do 120-ish.
Well, let's just do this. Let's get our metronomes out.
So here's 120.
Okay, we'll make it faster. Make it 140.
140, I bet. You could do it.
Could you go to like 160?
I think that's around the edge.
But we tried it with his quartet.
All right, ready?
Yeah.
Wow. I just want to go run out in the snow. That was fantastic. You totally nailed 160.
I don't know if it's a nail.
Well, okay.
That is a Beethoven I can dig right there. Thanks first and foremost to Alan Pearson at the Brooklyn Phil and to the incredible players.
I'm Deborah Buck.
Violin.
I'm violin too. I'm Susie Perlman.
Arash Amini. I go by Joey. I'm cellist.
Ollie New on the viola.
Thanks also to Kathleen Coughlin from the Brooklyn Phil and Matthew Guerreri, who wrote the book The First Four Notes, dun 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 dun, which is a great read about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
And thanks, of course, to Ludwig von B. and his lovely metronome.
Yes, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
We'll be back in a bit.
This is Dustin Powell.
And Alex Torres.
We are recording from the mass of people leaving the Radiolab live production at Oakland's Paramount Theater.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Union of Concerned Scientists, Science for a Healthy Planet and a Safer World. More at UCSUSA.org.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org.
And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at Lemelson.org.
Thank you, Radiolab.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.